Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Sometime in 2014, I read an article in the Financial Times about a group of Syrian female refugees living in Jordan, performing the Trojan Women, largely as drama therapy. The Syrian civil war was then in its third year and was already awful. These women were using Euripides to cope with the very modern tragedy of the al-Assad's brutal dictatorship, combining the Greeks' timeless narrative with their own traumatic stories. I tracked down the producers and invited them to bring the Syrians to a workshop that the Tilburg Foundation was holding near Geneva, Switzerland. I still remember witnessing an absolutely amazing performance, laden with a depth of tragedy that even the greatest actors would be challenged to produce. These women had actually lived the tragedies about which Euripides had only written. Fast forward to today. The Syrian war has finally ended, although the human tragedy of lives lost, lives shattered, and lives irreversibly altered will linger forever. The war's end got me wondering what had happened to the people who had this brilliant idea that modern Syrians, as well as other refugees, might better cope with their tragedy through the words and wisdom of ancient Greeks. I am delighted to welcome Charlotte Eger and William Sterling, the award-winning filmmakers behind the Trojan Women Project, to this edition of New Thinking for a New World.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, Alan, for inviting us on.
I think we need to start with the underlying concept and sort of how it's evolved over the years. I know you both read classics in college, so you obviously knew Euripides. Not personally, but through his work.
We're old,
but not that old. But what made you imagine that those wonderful antique stories could be the path to help women and men, not just Syrians, but others in the 21st century, cope with the consequences of brutal wars?
Well, we both covered the war. We both worked in Bosnia in the early 90s, and me as a journalist and my husband as an aid worker. And I went to Bosnia straight after Oxford, literally on an Interrail ticket. And that autumn, I was in my flat in Ukraine. And I was based in Ukraine as a freelance journalist then, and listening to the World Service, and they had the Trojan Women. And because I just left university and also was very bored and lonely, like many foreign correspondents, I listened to it and I thought, oh my God, these are the same stories I've been hearing from all the refugees I've been interviewing all summer. Nothing has changed. Exile, loss, rape, murder, death, destruction. Nothing has changed. War is eternal. Only the weapons change. Nothing, frankly, hardly even the locations change, you know. For the people, it's the same. And so that always stayed in the back of my mind. And Willie also, he worked in Bosnia and he raised a lot of money to a convoy.
I went to a northern city in Tuzla. And actually on the way back, had a very interesting moment actually when we had a bit of a car crash.
Literally.
Common. But yeah, it was a car crash on the way back from delivering our aid to Tuzla. And so I just spent, my colleague and cousin was injured, and so he was in the British Army base. And while I was there waiting to see how he was going to be, the front line had moved a little bit, and the British base was in this school, and the whole gym was filled with Bosnian Muslim refugees who had literally just left their houses.
Well, it was the fall of Yaitse, wasn't it?
It was the fall of Yaitse.
It was the fall of Yaitse, which was one of the great tragedies of the first... Yeah. Part of the war.
And so I was sitting there and while I was waiting to find out what was going on, I was very kindly invited to sit in the officer's mess I spent most of my time for a day. And there was two regiments there, three regiments. One of them was the Cheshire's County Infantry Regiment, and the other was Royal Irish Regiment, which was a mixture of a Northern Irish and a Southern Irish regiment who were combined. And the young officer of the Cheshire's, who just come from the gym, and he said to he said, well, it's really awful, but at least they're safe, and at least they'll be fine, you know, after a while. I mean, it's horrible, but they'll be fine. And a grizzled major who had been obviously in the Ulster Defence Regiment, now part of the Royal Irish Regiment, literally turned round on his bar stool and said, they will never be the same. He said, my father was burnt out of the Ardoyne in 1968, and he left with one plastic bag with what he could carry, and he was never the same again. And it really struck me that, about what it means to... He had just moved from a Catholic area to a Protestant area within a small city. What it means to be a refugee, and that was the first sort of moment in while I was in Bosnia that it really struck me.
And so then, if you roll forward, you know, many years, and Willie and I finally got together, having met on an ancient Greek course when we were 17, and failed to start going out with each other. We then got together when we were about 40, and we made a film, a short rom-com that weirdly got into Cannes and won a lot of prizes in America. And nothing happened as a result of that at all, except we were then hired to go by Marks and Spencer's to go to Africa and do some training films for their vegetable packers. And we thought, and that's where we learned the power of drama therapy. So we thought the films were really boring. They were done with an NGO, and they had these messages like, don't get drunk.
They all lived in the slums.
Yeah, they all lived in the slums in Nairobi. So don't get drunk. If you've got a job, turn up to it. You know, don't sleep with a gang leader. Don't be the gang leader. Don't get A's, that sort of thing. And Willie thought, well, why don't we turn this into a soap opera based on The Simpsons about a sort of functional family, a dysfunctional family? So we did that, and we workshopped the script for a week with the vegetable packers. And then we shot it on location in Dandora, this extraordinary, very visually powerful slum where they all live around Africa's biggest rubbish dump. And the effects were absolutely extraordinary. We discovered the power of drama therapy and also the power of this kind of art as a communications device. So firstly, the drama therapy side of it, it was very clear the people we worked with underwent an enormous change while we were there. They became much more self-confident. They became, the word is empowered. You know, they'd achieved something very difficult and complicated. They were very good at it. People had bothered to listen to them. You know, they also got paid. They got a nice hot lunch. Their children were looked after. It was a pleasant experience for them all round. And they got their messages across because they worked the scripts with us. What their concerns were in there, what they minded about was in there, what they thought, rather than what we thought they ought to think. And then the next thing was, because they were essentially playing characters, I mean, it was fiction, but they were playing characters very close to themselves, their performances were incredibly powerful. And so it worked as a piece of telly, basically. And we don't know how many people have seen it now, but we do know about 8 years ago, it was over 750,000 people. Admittedly, I think they were all forced to sit by their employers.
They all worked for a huge agri company called
VegPro.
VegPro in Africa.
But VegPro said their productivity had gone up by something like 75%. I mean, it was a really staggering amount. And so they were completely thrilled with the project. And so on the back of that, we realized that you could do both a process and a product. You could have a process that was beneficial to what, you know, development workers call stakeholders, but also created a product that could then communicate their message.
But it does require great storytelling.
Oh, yes.
You're both storytellers, and absent a great story, it's just blah, blah, blah.
No, you have to be good at telling stories. And we are quite good at telling stories. I mean, you may have thought I was rambling a bit there, but generally we are quite good at telling stories. But you have to say, we wrote those stories. But we then approached Oxfam and said, can you think of something that would work with you guys where we could do something for your stakeholders, but also you would have a communication tool that would communicate what Oxfam's doing in this place. And the woman said, oh, we wish you could think of something for our Syrian refugees. And in those days, it's hard to imagine now, but the Syrian refugee crisis was very, very underreported, you know, in 2013. People really weren't paying any attention to it at all.
It was yet another thing in the Middle East.
And all the refugees were basically in the Middle East and neighbouring countries, and it was kind of quite far away and nobody paid any attention to it. And we immediately thought of the Trojan women, because we absolutely understood it had to be similar to their own experience. And because we'd both studied at university and because we'd both worked in wars, and we absolutely knew. So that's where the origin of the project came from, the origin of the idea came from. And then initially, and of course, Euripides is one of the greatest storytellers of all time. And, you know, that's why this play has lasted the way it has done. It's an incredibly powerful story. And for anybody who doesn't know the story of the Trojan women, it's set after the fall of Troy. All the men are dead. The women are in a camp waiting to find out what's happening to them, in the Greek camp, as prisoners, waiting to find out what's going to happen to them. And it's not very nice. And as much as there is any plot, It's just basically, just when you think things can't possibly get worse, they actually do.
But what they examine is the loss of their status.
Yeah.
And the fact that they are no longer what they're going to be. And it's particularly, they all talk about this, but particularly Queen Hecuba.
Yeah.
Yesterday I was the queen.
Yeah.
Today I'm going to be the slave of, as it turns out, Odysseus. And I'm not even, I'm an old woman. I'll just be the, I'll be in rags at the back door, letting the tradesmen into the palace. But she was still being treated as a queen by the other women because they looked to her for the leadership. But she knew what was going to happen. And she just, and it was this sort of thing, am I what I am or what I was? What is the difference now? And so all of these women were going to basically, they're going to another country. They're going as slaves. But essentially the experience of exile, the experience of the loss of your home, which is being destroyed behind them, and the loss of their community.
Which is why the spine of that story is so immediately relevant to those women sitting in a Jordanian camp.
Yeah.
Don't think they're ever going home. Many of them have lost the men in their lives, their fathers, their sons, their partners. And this gave them a way to explore that loss, that tragedy. The way you did it, just to tell the audience, the way you did it was to combine both Euripides' words with their own stories. And that was the real power, as I witnessed it, that it was, you got that connection of the thousands of years of connection, the point you made, Charlotte, that it's the same damn thing over and over and over again.
So from a kind of literary point of view, what we do is and this model was essentially created by Omar Boussada, who was the director of the first. We produced this play many times now, I mean, many times. But and we're now working with a mixture of Syrians, lots of Iranians, Afghans, Ukrainians, Saudis. I mean, a real hodgepodge of refugees, all of whom essentially have very similar stories. So we plait all their stories together into the text of the play. And you know, if the one person says, and then the Taliban took Kabul, and then the next person says, and then everything just disappeared, poof.
Yeah,
and
it doesn't,
because the Russian took Kherson. So it's a plait. It's the same. So basically what we do is we keep some of the main soliloquies from Euripides and a couple of them and the choruses, not all of them, quite a lot of them.
Some of them,
and chuck the rest out. And then we plait everybody else's stories through. And it's evolved a lot since the first version of it. So we're very lucky now in that we have about three or four professional performers in our project at the moment. Well, we've remodeled the project so that we can tour it around the country through a series of community drama workshops, because we were always being asked to tour the play. But as Alan knows, because he took us to Geneva, it's very complicated touring amateurs, and particularly if they're refugees as well and asylum seekers, you're in a very complicated situation. So what we basically do now is we tour through community drama workshops where we work with different refugees in different locations around the country. But we have with us a core cast of Hecuba, Cassandra, so Andromache, and a singer who are professionals, but they are refugees. So we have a Syrian Palestinian, a Hecuba, we have a Ukrainian, Cassandra, we have one of Ukraine's top poets, and who's also a very good amateur actress, plays Andromache, and she works her own poetry into the text of the play. And then we have, luckily for us, a former Ukrainian Eurovision Song Contest contender who comes on and sings a sad song and then goes off again. You know, so that works very, very well. This is the way it works as a communication tool, is that you bring these two things together, the ancient and the modern. And then for the audience watching it, they realize that these people who are telling their own stories are just like them, that they're not like weird cockroachy people. You know, they are, you know, they're taxi drivers like them, or cooks like them, or lawyers like them, or doctors like them, or, you know, Eurovision Song Contest contenders. You know, it could be them. So this is the real point of the communication aspect of it. It's communicating to the host community, to the wider world, that there but for a catastrophe go you and me. You know, that could be us.
It's working on two levels. One, it's working among the refugees, asylum seekers, et cetera, as both as therapy and as project, as literally employment, which is also terribly important to people that have nothing. But it's also, over the years, it's become this powerful communications tool that tells the story of refugees to audiences that otherwise get their news from Fox or Star, the Mirror, or wherever they get it from, and usually get pretty negative stories.
But even if they got it from the BBC or CNN, they don't, you know, they might still turn off. You feel this thing that the camera has panned back to show you how many people rather than the people themselves.
It's the whole thing of a child drowning is a tragedy. A million people dying in an earthquake is a statistic. You know, but it hasn't necessarily evolved into this. It was always designed to be this from the very beginning. It was designed to be absolutely, you know, communicatable. So, you know, I've been a journalist for many, many years, and I know very well that refugee has rubbish life is not news, but refugee puts on a Greek tragedy and it's good. That gets on CNN. So our first one was you know, the FT, the Newsweek, France 2, La Repubblica, France 2 did 10 minutes on it. Al Jazeera, it was Reuters photograph of the week, the BBC. You know, it was designed to be covered by newspapers. And journalists always like covering wars and refugee stories and things like that. But their editors, frankly, quite often think they're a bit boring, don't really want to put them in. So by giving them a kind of sexy, cool, interesting way, a new take, a way to, it's like cookery, it's a spicing it up. You know, you cut it into, you know,
it's a way of telling the story.
Dress the story in a way that people actually want to consume it.
Yeah. And in a way, this is what's so serendipitous about the Trojan Women in two ways. One was that obviously it was a bridge for people to go, oh yeah, I'd be interested in that play, the Euripides Trope and Wind, I kind of know that, or know of it, story Troy, I know. But the other thing was that the women, when we had the play just translated for them to read, before Omar, you know, before they started, we started chopping it up, they all identified with
all of them.
The play. They said, this play could have been written about us. Mm. This is us. I'm Queen Hecuba, I was the queen.
It was written about them.
Yeah, it was written about them, yeah.
Yeah, and it was. And so that is a connection. And what's the genius of that play, actually, is it's not a straightforward Greek tragedy hitting all those marks. It was an admonition to the people of Athens.
Yeah, it was a howl of rage.
Howl of rage for the Athenian war crime committed the year before Euripides wrote it.
The Athenians had taken the neutral island of Milos and they killed all the men and sold all the women and children to slavery. And Euripides was, you know, the lovey of his time, was absolutely outraged by this, and he wrote this play as a reaction. And what was very discombobulated for the Athenian audience was that the goodies are the weird, nasty, foreign, barbarian women, and the bad guys are all the Greek heroes.
You know, all of whom have done specific war crimes.
Yeah.
So and I think there's something in that, the way he wrote that, and why he wrote it.
It's the only
that
time
kind of makes it. It seems to come down the ages and make it specifically sympathetic and specifically aimed at a possible hostile audience.
And so, also, I mean, Hecuba's first great lament is something that resonates to anybody who's even lost their job, let alone anything else. You know, oh, miserable woman, lift your head up from the ground. You know, say you are nothing then, after all. You know, Troy has gone. You know, and then somebody sings, the chorus goes, this is a very different song to the song I sang, was it only yesterday? You know, anybody who's been fired knows that experience. And if you've lost your home, it's even more so.
Do you know leaders who, regardless of where they live or what they do, are changing the world? Leaders who are not content with what is and are working hard for what could be. Leaders with both a demonstrated track record and the potential for continued impact. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values, and global in approach or implication. If so, please nominate them for the Telberg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize at telbergprize.org. The nominations will be open from March 15th to May 15th. Thank you. So these are actors, but they're people who have suffered, really, as you just said, terrific loss. They're refugees.
The professionals are all refugees.
Right.
So Arwa, who plays Hecuba, in fact, we have a podcast called Why Am I in Your Country? And Arwa is one of the, in fact, she was our first episode of that. Arwa, who is a Syrian-Palestinian, went to study drama school, studied law, actually, at Damascus University, and then trained to be an actress. And then the war started, so she went to Lebanon. She actually worked on a BBC soap opera in Lebanon for a bit. And then she went back to Damascus because they all got kicked out of Lebanon. The Palestinian Syrians got kicked out of Lebanon. And ISIS had overtaken her suburb, and she was an actress. So that obviously was like, you know, her death warrant. So she then paid $1,500 to a people smuggler, walked through Kurdistan for about 5 weeks, and in August was very nearly died, was very nearly raped, had to swim across a couple of rivers, finally got to Greece, where her people trafficker in Greece gave her a stolen American passport and advised her that she should fly out of Corfu because they didn't check anybody because it's a holiday airport. And she flew from Corfu to Gatwick, where she claimed asylum. So that's her. And then Alina, who's Cassandra, is Ukrainian. And, you know, she fled Kiev when the bombardment started. Olga, who's Andromache in the poet, she was actually, they were occupied by the Russians. She comes from Kherson, you know, her town was conquered and she had 10 days living under occupation. And then she said, I saw a tank. You know, she said, I saw a boy shot at a bus stop and he was not much younger than my son. And I knew then we had to leave.
But these are terribly personal stories and personal experiences that are traumatic experiences. How do you, from the front of the room, from the directing this, from thinking about it, how do you define the boundary between what's too deeply private, too deeply personal, and what's a good story that will get the audience to understand? That's a tough call.
It is up to them. There are people who want to be involved, don't want to necessarily tell their story, but like to be in the chorus, and they might contribute. It depends how the play is structured. But really, it's about the people who really want to tell their story. Mm. And in particular with the Syrians, we always had this problem, which is that some people wanted to say something political and others didn't want to because they were worried about what might happen to families in Syria or whether they wanted to go back to Syria. It was under Assad. And because a lot of people, you know, they weren't pro the revolution. They may have joined some of the demonstrations, but a large amount of people were just, you know, their streets were turned into rubble and they had to get out. And they weren't either pro or anti the revolution. They just wished their life could go back to normal. There was a man who was the project we did in Glasgow. He was a tailor who had the same name as a prominent activist journalist. And so he was picked up and brutally tortured. And he managed to get out.
He was in prison for a year or so.
He was in prison for a year. And he left. And then he had to hide for 2 years in a basement.
And he's a very nice man, but he was absolutely not a member of Damascus's intelligence.
No.
I mean, not at all.
Anyway, so in the Glasgow production, he started talking about this. This is what I want to say. And there was this argument because I said, please don't say that. Please don't say anything political. Don't say anything about the war. And Essam, who worked with us, said, well, we've got to explain why we're here in Scotland, you know, benefiting from the largesse of the Scottish and UK governments. He said, well, let's just say there was a war and then we had to leave. And we actually, because this argument always occurred in every production, and then we came to some arrangement about, you know, how that message or those messages would come across. We incorporated it with an at chorus and anti-chorus thing. So obviously it was about, we have to tell the people of Scotland why we're here, why we've turned up. And others saying, yes, but let's not get too political. And then one person, Mohammed Matar in this case, said, I'm here in a free country. Why should I still feel fear here? Why should, you know, this thing's happened to me and I think people should know. So it's a tightrope. And it is a balancing act so that, you know, everyone is kind of happy with where they've got to by the time the play is finalized and we're rehearsing it, etc. But sometimes people change their minds. They're not professional actors. I mean, apart from our core cast, but they're, you know, they've done two or three productions already.
And also, a lot of people do come to the workshops and they don't want to go on stage at all. So, for example, the current project we're doing in Hounslow, which is backed by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, and we're very grateful to them. Thank you very much. You know, we budgeted for 6 months and 35 people for a workshop, and we got 120, mainly Iranian. So it's had to go on for a year, you know, because but we're actually on stage. We're only going to have 15, you know, because people really wanted to be part of the workshop. So they're all very lonely. Refugees, asylum seekers, they're terribly lonely. Loneliness is one of their big problems. And so people always say that what we do is we create an extended family for them. And that was funny enough. The one thing we didn't realize at the beginning, we knew when we first started this project, we understood that, we were providing them with therapy, group therapy. We understood that we were giving them some money. We understood that we were giving them a nice hot lunch that they could share with each other. And we understood
that they were getting a platform.
They were getting a platform to tell their story to the world. We understood that that would then be multiplied massively by the films and by the PR that we did. And all this. We understood all of those things. The one thing we absolutely didn't understand was that we were creating community bonds within the cast. you know, so they all think of themselves as a sort of huge extended family. And last night we did this Zoom, as I said to earlier, to Michigan State University last night, we did a Q&A and a screening of one of our films, Queens of Syria, which is about our original project in Jordan. And and we had a Zoom Q&A afterwards. And because of the wonders of Zoom, you know, we had Maysoon and Fadi from, you know, Fadi, the boy, was Oliver. And when we produced the first ever Arabic adaptation of Oliver 10 years ago in Jordan, he's now like a kind of preppy at university, speaks fluent English. The his mum, Maysoon, who was in our original cast and came to Geneva with you, Alan, and Reem, who again, original cast, came to Geneva in the UK. And then Essam, who was in... who was in the Glasgow project. And there they were, all they've all met at other Zoom events, because we had, during COVID, we had to put the whole thing online. So we ran a black comedy project, which was actually Essam's idea, where we had people zooming in from all over the Middle East and Europe and the UK, and all coming to do these black comedy workshops online. But it is, you know, it's a family, it's a community, and they all recognised, didn't they? Some of them knew each other already, but even the ones that didn't, they recognised that they had this huge sort of bond in common.
When we did this project, we did a smaller creative writing audio drama project in Aberdeen with resettled Syrians in Aberdeen. And they called it... We call this big table, little table. So in the UK, we import people when we were resettling Syrian refugees and others in nuclear families, mum, dad, kids. Whereas they actually all live in, you know, Syria or in extended families, because there isn't really a welfare state. There's, to a certain extent.
They don't live necessarily in the same house, but they're just terribly close. The community is terribly close.
So the point was that every Friday... They would gather for their big weekly lunch. It would be 30 or 40 of them, you know, with grandpa and grandma, and that was their unit. And so surviving without that support unit of other people who knew them and could look after them, and they're in a country where they don't know the language, or the language is difficult to them, the systems are different. It's, you know, it's jolly generous, I mean, benefits and stuff like that, but still... It's very difficult. They've got to negotiate all sorts of things to do with local council. Some of them are asylum seekers, so they also have to deal with the Home Office. Having a community where people are at different stages, when they just get to know each other, then they have a support group, rather like the family, the extended family, they used to be their unit.
And another point that's worth making is that most of them, Syrians particularly, are in arranged marriages. So... they may not actually, you know, their spouse may not be their favourite human being in the entire universe. You know, their favourite human being in the entire universe may have been their second cousin, who was the person that they used to complain to about everything and hang out with, and he was their mate. But that person's not there anymore, because that person's in, Germany, or, you know, Jordan,
Turkey.
Or Turkey, or still in Syria. So I mean, Essam, for example, was in an arranged marriage, and he came over here, and he lost everything. He was a very distinguished businessman before the war. He created something called Global Village in Jordan, where over a million, it was a sort of trade fair where over a million people would come every year. And now he's been living in a council estate in some ghastly little town south of Glasgow for the last decade. But he lost everything, including his wife, because she was in an arranged marriage and she'd married somebody rich. And when they ended up in this not very nice place, she said, "You know what, I'm out of here, I'm sorry." And she doesn't live far away. She lives in the same not very nice place, about four streets away, but she married somebody else. You know, so yeah, it's very, very difficult. And so these projects do create this extended family, this community.
You mentioned in passing a couple moments ago Oliver.
Yes.
Oliver is certainly not Euripides.
No.
A few words about Oliver.
Yeah, so we were asked in the wake of, actually it was, I think, in about 2014. Some of the women involved in your tour in the original project, so I wish you could do something with our kids, because they're all depressed, and you know that it would. And serendipitously, someone had come along who was a donor.
Yes, it's one of the problems we have. We have fantasist donors. So, so we had a fantasist donor who got in touch and said, "I'm immensely rich Norwegian. I want to give you £100,000 to do a project for music and drama for children in Syrian refugee children." Fine. So it took us 3 days to design the Oliver project, and because we thought it's got to be something that they can identify with. You know, it's got to be fun for them, and it's got to be something they can identify with. Like the women could identify with Euripides, we thought, well, with Oliver, these kids are, you know, in an orphanage, you know, they'll be able to identify with Oliver. And by the time we designed this project, which really didn't take at all long, because I mean, it was sort of two conversations of, bing, shall we do Joseph or shall we do Oliver? Let's do Oliver, the music's nicer. The fantasist had lost his attention span of a gnat, like so many men like that, and he'd moved on to some other dream that he had. We later discovered he'd been married about five times. So
anyway, the point was,
we designed it by then. So we then went to Cameron McIntosh,
who owns the rights to
Oliver, and said, "What do you think?" And he said he thought it was an absolutely wonderful idea. And so we, the whole part of the deal was we were making a documentary about it, because we always make documentaries as a multiplier. Or films, anyway, as a multiplier of the reach of our projects, because the there's a limited amount of people who can actually fit into a theatre or go to that place. But with a film, once you've made the film, you can see it absolutely anywhere, including Michigan State University last night. You know, so you can see it anywhere. So Gary McIntosh was very keen on this idea and very keen on us doing a documentary about it. So we then. He didn't give us all the money. He gave us about a third of it. And we then had to go and raise quite a lot more money. And we got this brilliant Egyptian creative team in, led by somebody called Khaled Abul Najjar, who's a sort of movie star and a hero. He's a bit like the George Clooney of the Middle East. And it was translated by Disney's top translator in the Arab world, is a woman called Zainab Mubarak. And it was updated to a modern Arab city, because, as Cal said, you know, these kids, we have Oliver everywhere here. You know, there's no welfare state in the Middle East. You see the street kids, that they're a fact of life. Whereas Lionel Bart, the guy who wrote the musical Oliver in the first place, obviously it's based on Charles Dickens, but Lionel Bart wrote the musical. He always said that you couldn't modernize Oliver, you couldn't update it to a modern city in the UK because we have a welfare state. So it would not be true. But in the Middle East, it's true. And in fact, Fadi, the boy who played Oliver, and if any of your listeners want to give somebody a scholarship to go to university, he'd be really, really be up for a master's because he's frightfully clever. He said Oliver was a boy fighting for his rights, just like me. He completely got it. And the boy who...
So just to make clear, the junior cast of Oliver were all Syrian refugees, yeah, and a few Jordanian underprivileged kids. And we approached it through working with four schools in this very poor area, yeah, of Amman. And we did music and drama workshops. And then we had a bunch of auditions. From that, we chose the junior cast. And the senior cast were played by mostly amateurs, except for one opera singer.
Yeah, we had an Egyptian opera singer played Mahami. And the reason why they were Egyptians is because the Egyptian film industry and the entertainment industry is the sort of main one in the Arab world, or was back then. And really, they were more enthusiastic about it than, in fact, they were incredibly enthusiastic about it, whereas the Jordanian cultural side was perhaps less enthusiastic. But although they definitely came on board towards the end of the project. And we ran it for about 7 or 8 months. Basically, we ran Oliver Camp. And the documentary, which is coming out this year, is called Where Is Love? And it is absolutely charming. It really is. And it just follows the kids, a bit like Queens of Syria, the documentary that you saw. It follows the kids from the very beginning, when they can't sing for toffee, right to when they are the toast of Amman. And we put the play on for a week. We put the musical on for a week in Jordan, in Amman. And the people said it was the best show they'd seen in Jordan in 20 years. I mean, that was very nice of them, but it was really very good.
It worked, obviously, as a performance. How did it work as therapy?
When the film comes out, people will be able to see it. It worked. So Fadi, who was the boy who was chosen to be Oliver, he is his Maysoon's son, who was project, yeah, who you met in Geneva. I remember my first meeting him in that first project in 2013. He was like a little whey-faced, ginger-haired ghost. He never said anything at all. And so he then joined the project. I mean, he then auditioned, and because he could roughly sing, he was included in there. They had to choose who was going to be Oliver. And when Khaled chose Fadi, I went, "You've chosen Fadi as Oliver, but he doesn't say anything." And what happened was he became more and more confident. And as the musical director, Naya Nagui, who was the ex-conductor of the Akara Opera, has said, he said, "It's astonishing. This guy, we couldn't get him to open his mouth. I mean, to say two words. And now he's singing, dancing. He's holding a two-hour performance." You know, and he said, "It's crazy." But, you know, and Fadi, who really was, I mean, very sort of closed off. One that, just to sort of slightly divert, when we did our first project, we had a creche. And the creche was full of these kids.
Childcare facility.
Childcare facility. And all of these kids who'd come with these women who were very newly out of Syria, so they're still in the first shock of being refugees. And the women were, you know, it took them time to sort of start to get their confidence back. The kids, as our monitoring psychologist, Dr. Hamed, said, you know, children have no way of processing these thoughts. Adults do, but children don't. And the childcare facility was, you know, these kids could hardly be parted from their mothers. And then when we got a whole load of toys from London, you know, from some friends of ours who had lots of kids had spare toys. We took them out there and we gave them to these kids. And there was like a sort of Barbie massacre. They didn't know what they were drawing on the walls. They'd ripped everything to pieces. And Dr. Ahmed, who was there to really monitor what was happening with the women, then switched to the kids and introduced a more structured play, education, you know. And by the end, they were a lot more socialized than they had been in that moment. Because, of course, they had seen things.
Yeah, they'd seen terrible things.
You know, they couldn't. Reem last night was talking about her younger sister. You know, when they were getting out of Damascus, they had to go through a street where, you know, a helicopter gunship had mowed down an entire protest. And she said, we held her, is her little sister. You know,
she said the street was a river, it was a day after, the street was a river of blood and filled with body parts everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And they covered her eyes, but she said, my little sister could still smell the blood. She could smell the blood. And she said, even now she's not right. They can't work out. They had an assessment of her, you know.
Whether she was autistic or
whatever it was, or PTSD, yeah. She's not right. She has never quite come right.
And they still don't know why. Yeah. I mean, you know, medically.
I brought up Oliver because I was hoping to end on a positive note.
Oh, right, sorry.
Yeah, it's a positive note. So Oliver does have a happy ending, and because Oliver gets reunited. And the kids who were in it, for them, it was really a life-changing experience. And we then ran about three more years of sort of legacy projects in Jordan with them. And they've all come out of it pretty well, haven't they?
Yeah, they have,
happy. I mean, Fadi is, you know, he's a poster child.
He learned English.
He speaks fluent English now, and he's studying cybersecurity.
But he's still topping a Syrian refugee in Jordan. I mean, so, they kind of want to get rid of them.
Yeah, so he's now not allowed to work legally. Since, did we say this on the podcast? I can't remember. So he told us last night that the Jordan, because he's putting himself through college working as a barista, and he's trying to get to pay for his sister so she can go to university as well, because otherwise she has to have an arranged marriage, which he doesn't want her to have, and she doesn't want either. She wants to read psychology, so we're looking for somebody to sponsor her through university too. So he said that since the regime fell in Syria, the Jordanian government are now not allowing them to work legally any longer. So he's working as a barista to pay his university fees, and he said the authorities raided his bar a couple of days ago, and he had to pretend to be Jordanian. And they said, "Well, where's your ID?" And he then ran out through the kitchen. You know, so he's got real problems.
It's tough. Yeah. But also, you were mentioning earlier, just before we started, about, you know, what the Syrians think about since the fall of Assad.
Yeah.
They all absolutely delighted he's gone because it was just, you know, it was a brutal, brutal, horrible place. And those of those who had relatives who went back would come back, and Maysoon went back, actually, and she came back within a week. She wasn't going back permanently, but she was going to go for a month, see some of their relatives there. She came back. It was just, you know, brutal and terrifying. And they've all lost people who were, you know, arrested and disappeared into that awful prison. They are nervous, or rather slightly skeptical, I think, about where the new regime might end up. But they said this is the moment that they're rebuilding. At least you can go there. Mm. At least you can go there and do things and speak freely. It's not a, you know, that you can do. They're gradually rebuilding. They're actually, so they said, we should do this in Damascus. We should take the project to Damascus.
For Assam, who was a producer, is going to Syria in a couple of weeks' time. He said he was going to see if we could do it in Damascus.
That would be such a fabulous event and idea. It'd be full circle.
Yeah,
it would be amazing.
Let me thank you for this conversation and add just one small story. After the performance those many years ago in Geneva, a Swedish businessman who was part of the audience came up to me and said, I've been watching this war for 3 years. I have just tonight understood what it's all about.
Aww.
So that's precisely what you guys wanted to do.
Yeah, that's it.
Congratulations.
And thank you so much for asking to Geneva all those years ago. It was really very, very kind of you, and exactly what this is about. And, you know, I know it was all a bit fraught sometimes, but it was great. And thank you. And if anybody wants to know more about our work, we have a website, trojanwomenproject.org. And anybody wants to donate, do please, because we're very, very grateful, because we're always raising money, because we're always doing projects.
Thank you, Alan.
And we will link the website to the story. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, Alan. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.